Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And, Jim, we also want to let folks know we're sponsored today by SimpliSafe Home Security. For 24/7 protection you can really trust, go to simplisafe.com/ricochet. And, Jim, I'm sure you remember, I'm sure you wrote about this quite a bit back following the 2012 election. There was the big RNC autopsy report. Why did Republicans lose the 2012 election? And they came up with a lot of different things that ended up focusing on immigration and a couple of other key issues. And so there should be. I don't know if there actually is soul searching going on in the Democratic Party about why they lost, or they're just still so angry they can't even get around to thinking about it. But nonetheless, Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe earlier this week decided to ask former Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean about maybe some different ways to reach back into people who used to vote for Democrats. And Scarborough is specifically talking about how Democrats used to absolutely dominate the South because they were more culturally conservative. So, Howard Dean, is that a group that you would maybe like to try and reach out to and maybe try to win some votes from? And Howard Dean's answer might surprise you.
Can the Democratic Party ever have a big enough tent to have people who are progressive on economic issues and conservative on social issues in their party again?
No, because the young generation isn't that way. I think the old left-right is an anachronism. It exists in Washington. It exists in the media. Young people don't think that way. They're not ideological. They're extremely interested in social justice, so we're never going to go back to maybe making compromises on abortion and all these gay rights is another one. But they're more conservative.
So you don't want a Democrat in your party if they're for social justice, if they're progressives, if they agree with you on 90% of the issues, but they're also practicing Catholics who are pro-life? You don't want them in your coalition?
No, Joe, I didn't say that. What I said was,
like it.
Okay, maybe it did to you.
And the rest of America.
So, Jim, Howard Dean having a little problem there. Perhaps he doesn't think you can be for social justice and be pro-life at the same time. But hey, Democrats, keep dividing because it's working great for us.
Yeah, I notice how much in those comments he blurs the line between gay rights, where I think it's pretty indisputable that public opinion has shifted pretty dramatically and pretty quickly in support of those, and abortion, where actually the public opinion is shifting in the other direction, particularly amongst young people, which he cites. You're actually seeing young people are more pro-life than they were a generation ago. Certainly it is a more nuanced position amongst young people, and I think the public at large. Maybe the country isn't comfortable with the idea of a blanket ban on abortion, but there certainly is a growing moral and I think opposition, and it's kind of translating into a perspective both legally and in terms of what kind of laws we should have against partial birth abortion, for parental consent laws, for parental notification laws, and just a general opposition to late-term abortions. Americans may not be comfortable declaring that life begins at conception. But on the other hand, a 9-month-old fetus does not just strike them as a clump of cells that can be terminated without moral consequence. They have a nuanced position, and this is the sort of thing where if the, and let's face it, the Democratic Party's position is not morally nuanced. It is not merely that abortion should be illegal and on demand, available everywhere. They used to describe it as something that should be safe, legal, and rare. They dropped the "and rare" a couple of years ago. And now they basically believe, they're in their full-throated defenses of Planned Parenthood, that it's basically you're a bad person if you don't believe that taxpayer money should go to abortions. Now, the other reason I like spotlighting this is that Howard Dean, we all remember the, and this kind of his reputation as a crazy guy. I also got the feeling, I remember writing a profile for him way back in 2004 for National Review. I'm not going to say Howard Dean is dumb. I'm going to say that Howard Dean, as governor of Vermont, developed a knowledge about certain topics, and everything else he kind of had to make up for lost ground during that 2004 presidential campaign. And as we've seen for many candidates, whether you want to pick, Ben Carson, Herman Cain, anybody who comes from a whole bunch of governors, Tim Pawlenty, folks who I like will tell you that getting up to speed on every issue as a presidential candidate takes time. But that was like 12 years ago. And you'd kind of think that Howard Dean, particularly as an MSNBC pundit, would be a little more broadly well-read and more familiar with things. Greg, a little while ago, he tweeted something. This was March 4th, so a couple of days ago, over the controversy of Trump saying that he was wiretapped. He tweets out, "For those who may not know, a FISA warrant is used by a court to catch terrorists, set up after 9/11 by Bush." That's my Howard Dean voice there. This is not true. This is not close to true. This is so far from true, it takes several years for the light from true to reach what Howard Dean just tweeted. The FISA courts were set up in 1978. Yeah, they can be used in terrorism investigations, but they were set up for foreign spies, and it's most often used for counterintelligence. You get the NSA and the FBI doing this this sort of thing. They were not set up after 9/11 by Bush and all that kind of stuff. But the idea, so I guess the idea was that terrorism warrants were being issued again. It doesn't even make like just if you read his own tweet, you'd think something would have jumped out at him. Wait a second, this doesn't write. But I love the preface, "For those who may not know." Let Howard Dean explain it to you, okay? Let me drop a knowledge bomb on you. And of course, he gets everything completely wrong. So, yeah! The irony is also in 2004, Howard Dean was the guy who bragged about how he wanted this. He was endorsed by the NRA almost every time that he was the governor of Vermont. Now, this is because Vermont is an extraordinarily pro-gun state. It's the state of Bernie Sanders. It's the state of Ben and Jerry, liberal, hippie, progressive image. But they love their guns up there. And I believe back in the 2000s, somebody introduced a bill in the state legislature that would have required everyone in the state of Vermont to own a gun. You think I'm making that up, but I'm not. So at one point, Howard Dean was Mr. We got to reach out to these culturally conservative voters. We have to stop marching in lockstep on this. And somewhere along the line, he decided to drop that. And he's ready to expel all pro-lifers from the party. So, sure, every Republican Party will say, "Come on over, we'll take you."
Let's move to our bad martini today. And Jim, I don't know if you've noticed, there's a little bit of disagreement among folks on the right about the new House health care bill, the American Health Care Act, that would not be a full repeal. But the people who support it say that there's a lot here that would kind of lay the framework for a market-based system, massive improvements, get rid of a lot of the regulations and so forth. The debate's going to keep going on and on and on. But the way that the leadership and even the White House is dealing with conservatives who say this is not what we promised in the campaign and this is not going to be a successful way to reform the system, this is the way that it's being met. This is from the Washington Examiner. Quote, "If you like your Obamacare, you can keep it," Vice President Mike Pence told Republicans at a closed-door meeting Tuesday, "but the American people want change." The White House on Tuesday cast the GOP bill as a work in progress, a sign the changes may be necessary in order to move it through the House. Pence acknowledged that reality by saying, "as the legislative process goes forward, the GOP plan, quote, is the framework for reform, and we are certainly open to improvements and recommendations in the legislative process." But he also warned the GOP, this is the bill backed by President Trump. And then you have reports like this from Rachel Bade of Politico on her Twitter feed. "Whip sources tell me Trump agreed with their argument that this is a binary choice. Either you back a replacement that can pass or you keep Obamacare." Jim, regardless of what you think of this bill, the tactics, I think, ought to upset conservatives a lot, because we had 8 years of President Obama saying, well, do you want people to have health care or do you want to oppose this bill? Do you want kids to die in school shootings or do you want to pass common sense gun control legislation? It was always, you're a horrible person unless you want to do exactly what I want to do. And it doesn't look any better when Republicans do it.
Greg, did you lapse into a Barack Obama impression there for a minute?
Maybe.
I just got the tone of the voice, and I say, yeah, this is thoroughly depressing how this is going, because I'm among those who looked at this bill and, does it do everything I want? No. In fact, you could probably argue there are some really big pieces of the puzzle, including selling insurance across straight lines, trying to loosen up the requirements of what an insurance plan has to offer you. If you want to have a greater variety in options and also greater variety in costs for purchasing insurance. But on the other hand, I was seeing all of the standard conservative groups who have basically spent the last decade insisting Republicans are selling us out and we won't let them donate now so we can stand for real conservative. They were at it yesterday. And my sense is I don't buy the idea that Paul Ryan wants to sell out on Obamacare. I don't buy the idea that any of these guys deep down Love it. I think they've looked at the kinds of challenges and what has to be addressed. And there's this nagging feeling that we, you know, Obamacare tried to address everything people didn't like about healthcare in one giant bill. Everything had to be thrown into one. Everything had to be dealt with in one fell swoop. There was no ability to have gradual experimentation. There was no room for 50 states, each kind of doing their own their own levels, and their own efforts to improve it on their standards, which is probably the strongest part of this bill before Congress. I don't love it, but I kind of deep down know that no, I'm not going to love any replacement bill. There are a lot of competing interests here, and there's a lot of people like, well, just repeal it. Okay, but then you've got a whole bunch of problems. Among them, Trump said he was going to not touch Medicaid. Well, Obamacare expanded Medicaid. So if you repeal the whole thing, you repeal the expansion of Medicaid, you've got between 10 and 11 million people who were covered and who now suddenly aren't. So what do you want to do with those folks, right? I mean, I think at the very least, you got to have some sort of mechanism to move them towards private plans. And they're you know, probably going to have a hard time finding those plans to be affordable. So I don't like it. It felt like a group of piranhas just devouring the leg of a calf yesterday, watching the way folks responded to it, because the conservatives don't like it. The moderates don't like it. The prospect for repeal looks pretty bad right now, in part because, yeah, I can definitely see the flaws in this one. I just don't see a less flawed option coming along that's going to unite Republicans on this. The issue with people are like, oh, don't Republicans have a plan? No, no. The problem is not Republicans don't have a plan. The problem is they've got like six or seven different plans. And I don't know if any one of those six or seven could win a majority of Republican votes in the Senate or in the House and get support of the president, who I don't know about you, Greg. I can't help. I'd be curious about how thoroughly he studied this proposal. Because it was a very generic, it's terrific defense that obviously a lot of folks on the right did not see otherwise. By the way, for all the argument, like this is a bad martini because of how difficult the effort to repeal and replace is going. But remember, Greg, when Republicans were lawmakers were going to be these mind-numb drones who were just going to march in lockstep with whatever the Trump administration wanted?
Yeah.
Yeah, not shaken out that way, huh?
Not on this one.
Yeah. In fact, at this point, the Trump White House was saying, wait, where are these drones we were talking about? Why isn't everybody marching in lockstep the way everybody warned?
It's fascinating.
Where's obedience when we need it?
A month ago was the Super Bowl when Trump said this might come out in next year. So the timetable's been all over the place on this. My question is why we're not doing tax reform first. It would seem to have that house in order. You get a better idea of what the costs and the deficit impact would be with the health care reform. But I'm not a member of Congress, so I just think tax reform would be easier. And if you beat each other up on this, it's going to make tax reform harder to do, too.
On the one hand, conservatives will be ludicrously disappointed if a Republican Congress does not manage to get a repeal and replace bill enacted before the end of the year. On the other hand, conservatives, part of what's holding it up is conservatives not being pleased with this plan and not being able to unite against behind another plan. You know, you want Rand Paul and Mark Sanford? Try that one. You want to try the it was the Louisiana senator and Susan Collins had one that basically left enormous amount of leverage to the states and let them decide what they want. Guys, you got to unite behind something, and you got to recognize that whatever you unite behind is probably not going to leave you with 100% of what you want. So you got to really think about your priorities, what you really want most out of a change to Obamacare, and we'll see how things shake out. But right now, it's not looking very optimistic at all.
Okay, here's what they need to do. You said they had six or seven plans, right? They need to get one more. That gives you eight. That gives you an elite eight set of healthcare plans. Put it in a bracket.
In time for March Madness.
Exactly. Match two up. Whichever one gets more votes heads to the next line. That gets to the next line. There's your winner. Boom. I solved it.
There you go. That's a good segue to our third martini. I'm guessing the Republican majorities in Congress may not be feeling safe, Greg.
No, they're not, because some of them are worried about not backing up their promises. Others are worried about not getting reelected if they vote for something that goes against what their constituency likes. Is there a Simply Safe device for this? We're giving Simply Safe a lot of ideas here, so we need to be getting in on some of the profits if they ever actually go in this direction. But let's talk about what Simply Safe actually does and that they do very, very well, and that is protect your home. We've talked a number of times about the story out of California. There was a woman who was hired to clean homes, and she was robbing them blind at the same time. Who knows if she even did the cleaning? Imagine that. You pay someone to take care of your home, and they burglarize you. How do you protect yourself from something like this? Because a regular security system won't protect you from the people you know and trust.
Here's what you do. You get SimpliSafe, which makes it possible to know what's going on at your home. If you want to check in, you just live stream footage from the SimpliSafe camera directly to your smartphone. Anytime you like, you can get text message and email alerts when someone arms or disarms your system, so you can be sure and confident that your home is safe.
For 24/7 protection you can really trust, go to simplisafe.com/ricochet. Order a SimpliSafe home security system today, and you'll even get our special 10% discount. So go now, simplisafe.com/ricochet, SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. This is courtesy of Outkick the Coverage. Clay Travis is writing, 2 years ago, ESPN cut several hundred behind-the-scenes jobs to save hundreds of millions of dollars in yearly costs. Since that time, ESPN's subscriber losses have accelerated, averaging over 3 million lost subscribers a year. Now new jobs cuts are coming, only this time you're likely to know some of the casualties. Outkick has heard from a variety of different sources that ESPN is cutting up to $100 million in on-air salaries. Yep, on air. This means you're going to know many of the people leaving the network. He goes on to say, ESPN's collapse is the biggest story in sports, yet most still haven't realized it. That business collapse at ESPN has caused a panic at the network, a desperate grab for relevance that has led to a pronounced leftward move. ESPN's trying desperately to stay relevant as ratings collapse and subscribers flee. The decision will be MSESPN, the home for far left-wing politics and sports. Only it's not working. Over the past several years, ESPN has lost over 13 million cable and satellite subscribers. And this guy projects by 2021, they'll actually be losing money. So, Jim, we hate to see people lose their jobs regardless of the political bent. But there's good reasons why this is happening.
Yeah, look, the reason we hate seeing people lose their jobs is we look at this and say this is kind of avoidable. We should point out that there's more than one factor here. People wondered why the NFL ratings were down significantly at the beginning of last year. And some people said, oh, people are following the election more closely and things like this. Some people blamed Colin Kaepernick. Look, it's kind of hard to dispute that a good portion of ESPN's chat programming, ESPN now, we all remember from that movie a couple of years ago, the reference to ESPN 8, the Ocho.
Yes.
The idea that this is constantly breeding new channels, breeding like rabbits every time you turn around. There's ESPN, ESPN2, ESPNU, which focuses on collegiate sports. Is ESPN Classic still around?
I haven't seen it in a while, but I certainly remember it. Yeah.
Okay. It was ESPN reruns, basically,
yes.
Right? You know. Now, they showed the Jets Super Bowl win in 1969 like every year. So I liked that channel. I'm not saying there wasn't an audience. I'm just observing, you know. And then, you know, obviously, there's this huge web presence, and ESPN just keeps growing and expanding ESPN Radio. And on the one hand, oh, people love sports. On the other hand, and you know, people used to scoff at the idea of a 24/7 sports channel, thinking that there just wasn't enough going on. Well, now there clearly is. And ESPN has made itself obviously by far the most powerful force in sports media, and arguably one of the most powerful forces in sports entirely. Having said that, if you watch a lot of it, like me, it's on the gym when I'm working out and stuff like that, you notice there's ESPN sports coverage, i.e. watching the basketball game. There's ESPN highlights coverage, i.e. Sports Center, here's who won today. And then there's an awful lot of ESPN chat, and basically host talking. Now, sometimes you get shows I love, like Mike and Mike. And then sometimes you get Stephen A. Smith saying, you cannot do this, and yelling at people. Colin Cowherd used to be on. Now there's Fox Sports 1. ESPN has more competitors, right? There's people who are doing what ESPN used to do. ESPN is doing two things, though. One is very much directing its financial bottom line, and one that I suspect is driving viewers away. The driving viewers away aspect comes in politics. Look, yes, we know that there are some people in sports who are really into politics. I believe it was the sports columnist Jason Whitlock who said, look, there are a lot of people working in sports journalism who didn't really want to work in sports journalism. They're not that into sports, which strikes me as a sign you probably shouldn't be a sports journalist, right? You should, I understand you go looking for the jobs you can find, but ultimately, if you hate NASCAR, you probably shouldn't be a NASCAR correspondent because you're going to be dealing with it every day of work. There are a lot of people who are really into social justice warrior politics. And they're trying to bring that into sports, and they're trying to make the sports world political. There's a good article recently who said sports writing is now a liberal profession, and there was somebody at ESPN who basically said, hey, why aren't more baseball players speaking out against the Trump administration? Because we don't want them to, because we want to see, hey, can they tag the guy out before he gets to the base, right? What's his batting average? We want sports to be an escape from the troubles of life, not another venue in which we get to watch people arguing. Or if we're going to watch people arguing, Greg, we want it to be over perfectly rational topics like, hey, my team should trade this guy. Or how long is this guy going to be with an ACL going to be out? Or, you know, like, sports is kind of meant to be frivolous and silly. Yes, we recognize that it's a big business. And yes, we recognize that sometimes it intersects with real world problems like crime. But deep down, there was some sports writer who said sports is meant to be the toy department of life. And when you turn on ESPN and they're talking to you about the worst problems in the world, and how bad Trump is, and it gets more and more political, people will decide, I don't want this anymore, and they will tune it away. So for all the conservatives who are celebrating the serious problems of ESPN, we should also acknowledge it's not just a matter of people turning off because of politics. This article in Outkick, the coverage is fascinating. ESPN spends $7.3 billion for the rights to broadcast these sports in 2017, which is more than any other major media company is paying for. When they signed these contracts, ESPN viewership was going up, and they thought the good times were going to last forever. Well, they haven't. The audiences have not grown. People are cutting the cord, and that's why ESPN is partially where it is. The interesting thing is that they've turned to these liberal politics. And in fact, they've kind of turned away from what attracted their original core audience, sports, in order to try to save themselves. And my sense is this is only accelerating the decline. A really interesting example of this, Greg, I don't know if you've caught, and I'm sure people are wondering, hey, wasn't the 3-Martini lunch usually about politics? And now all of a sudden it's assessing ESPN? Look, this is the issue that gets me fired up. You're going to have to deal with this, listeners. 6 p.m. SportsCenter recently got taken off by Jemele Hill and Michael Smith. Two perfectly amiable, likable hosts. But even in the commercials, they say, this show isn't just about sports. It's also about music and pop culture and movie. Wait a minute. I thought it was called SportsCenter. Now, some people will point out, it's ESPN, the entertainment and sports programming network. And as one of their talk show hosts observed the other day, there is no J in there for journalism. The idea that journalism is a side dish of what the network offers, not the primary mission of it, which is kind of an interesting. I wonder how many times that's been an argument within the halls of ESPN with all the college mascots running around and things like that in the background. My suspicion is that ESPN is forgetting what people loved about it and why people tuned in and embracing this new identity in which they're really competing with MSNBC, thus the jokes about it being ESPN. I hope they wake up to this because, you talk about these mass layoffs and this departure of the on-camera talent. Look, guys, you kind of did this to yourselves, right? Go back to your core competencies. Go back to what made your viewers fall in love with you. And then I think you have a better chance of turning things around instead of reinventing yourself as the social justice sports network instead of irritating the audience and further eroding their audience. But that's my end rant. I don't expect ESPN to listen to me. But that's, I'll just be looking up less at the screens as I'm doing my workouts.
Sean Davis over at The Federalist earlier today got a screenshot of the Outside the Lines video archive. And here's the top few on here. Rubio says chances of moving Bill forward are very realistic. No idea what that's about. Jeannie Buss, the owner of the Lakers, uncomfortable relationship with her brother Jim. I assume that doesn't mean you. Is baseball's lack of a voice on social issues a problem? You mentioned that one. Sports and social issues don't mix much in current MLB. USA Gymnastics speaks out against reporting on alleged abuse. Transgender wrestler speaks out. Public opinion a challenge to transgender rights.
Any scores in there?
No.
But yeah, but who won the game? We'll have that right after this. Yeah.
It's so simple yet so elusive for them. Jim, on that note, enjoy your day without a woman. Although I'm guessing yours and mine are probably not taking part in that. And I'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Don't forget to go to simplysafe.com/ricochet for Simply Safe Home Security and get the 10% discount. And join us on Thursday for the next 3-Martini Lunch.